Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, if you've been listening to American Variety over the last, 6 years or so, you know that we often have authors on all kinds of genres, right? Thrillers, suspense, crime authors. We had a poet not too long ago. I don't recall that we've ever had on a novelist who delves into the world of mental illness. And I don't know how much he does in his other books, but we're here really today to talk with John Dufresne about his current book, Requiem Mass. And that's Mass as in Massachusetts, but obviously there's a pun involved there too. John Dufresne is a professor of creative writing in the Master of Fine Arts program at Florida International University in Miami. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Court. Good to be here.
Yeah, glad you're here with us. So why don't you just tell us the plot of Requiem Mass?
Well, basically it's an adult writer who has decided he's going to write a novel based on his childhood. And he writes it, and his girlfriend tells him it doesn't breathe. And she says, look, all this happened to you. Why don't you write a memoir? Just write about what happened, and you don't have to make things up. And so that's what he sets out to do, write a memoir of his childhood. And the childhood was an unhappy one in some ways because of the mother's sort of schizophrenic, delusional behavior toward her children. And also it was part of the reason for driving her husband, their father, away out of the family. He kind of just fled. He's a long-distance trucker, and he tries to stay on the road as much as he can, and it turns out he has, in fact, a whole secret life going on somewhere else. And it's growing up, and so the central character as a child, Johnny, who's the older of the two children, decides that what he has to do is keep the world away from their door, because if anybody finds out that the mother is in fact going mad, that the welfare will come in, take the children out of the home, and it's likely they'll be separated. And so he's pretending, wants the world to believe that everything is fine.
Okay, so how old is Johnny?
He's 10, I believe, when it begins, when the story starts, 10 to 12.
And how old is his sister?
6 when it begins.
Wow. So the weight of the world falls on this poor little 10-year-old, and his childhood is somewhat unhappy, but I think that's a pretty major understatement,
right?
Because they're dealing with a woman who's severely mentally ill as two children.
Yeah, and he's a kid. What drew me to write about him as a character is that as a child, he was pretty imaginative and creative, and it was his imaginative ability to make things up that would be plausible, that the world would believe that my mother is here. And he also, of course, had to lie to her, because when they had to flee the mother's crazy behavior, he just said, oh, we're going over to these people's houses to babysit. But there were no people. He made them up.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would take, there were some people in the neighborhood who understood what was going on, and he took refuge with them. And they, you know, they sort of, they were the village that raised the children in a way.
Wow. So all of the characters, really, except for maybe Johnny, all of the characters in the novel, and I have to admit, I've, you know, it's a 330-some-odd page book, and I, as I do often in the show, I've read the middle, and then I jump to the end, and then I read the beginning, and then mm-hmm. I spot read here and there throughout it. It's,
right.
You know, an extremely well-written book, which I guess is
thank you.
Is a gratuitous statement, since you're a teacher of creative writing. One would assume that could be taken. At face value. But anyway, so except for maybe Johnny, who holds himself together with amazing steely nerves, everybody seems to be kind of dysfunctional in the book. The father, for example, is a pathological liar and ends up having a second family somewhere else in the country, and these kinds of things go on. So is that a common feature of your books?
I think so. I first of all, I enjoy people who are somewhat eccentric, and I think that we all have...
I hope you'll enjoy this show, then.
Well, we all live our life in public, and we also have a private life, and everything important in these characters in my book's life goes on in their private life, and it's not who they pretend. They're not pretending, but it's not who they present themselves to the world. It's not their presentation self. Mm-hmm. We all have secrets, and everything important in our hearts and minds is going on behind the closed doors. And there are things that we do that in the light of day might seem odd, but we all have our things that we do, and everybody has difficulty. And people in trouble and people who fail and people who are flawed are the interesting people to write about. And we all are. We know we are. We don't want people to know that we are. But so I just peeled it back a little bit. It's like, look, look, you know, so there's a one guy, you know, who maybe he drinks too much, and another guy, you know, there is the neighbor downstairs who says, you know, I you know, nobody knows my thirst, why I have to drink and all that, and that sort of thing. But I like to get at the vulnerability in people. And so there's a lot of the walk-on characters, the characters who have smaller roles in here, are people, because of the mother's condition, people that she comes in contact with, that they're all kind of hurting and suffering souls, I guess, and trying to get through with their disabilities, you know, mostly in this case, emotional and mental disabilities.
Well, you know, I mean, that's often the grist for the mill for a novelist, right? I mean, if you were just writing about Ozzie and Harriet, it would
We don't want to read about happy people in Happy Valley. I mean, that's not... The only thing interesting is trouble.
Or things that are grandiose, you know, somebody who's saving the world in some way, you know, something that's larger than life.
But even then, we want to know the flaw, right? You know, the tragic hero has a flaw.
Yeah.
You know, and what is it? What brings the character down?
So I have to ask you, you kind of play, certainly in the beginning of the book, in a kind of a teasing way with the assertion that it's the story of your family.
Right.
As the author, you are, you know, the narrative character.
Right.
The person telling the story is a novelist, and you are a novelist.
Right.
And
he lives in my house.
By the way,
he's got my name.
you're both named John, right? So, yeah,
right.
So I don't know if you're from Requiem, Mass, or some similar town.
Yeah, that's my town in my neighborhood. Although it's not, it's not Requiem in real life. Changed it, and of course, it the feeling I have about that time going up there is a kind of funereal, you know, of course it works as a pun and whatnot. So
sure.
Is he going to call it Critical Mass or Requiem Mass? So I chose
Critical
Requiem.
Mass, people would have thought it was about nuclear war or something.
Right.
So, but anyway, I guess the question I was dancing around with there, is it really you? Because you're kind of setting it up in the novel as if it really is a memoir rather than fiction. And
But of course, on the cover it says it's a novel, and it's made up. And what it is, it's based on certain events or certain characteristics or certain things. Some of the things in the novel did happen to me. Most of them did not. And the things that did, most of them are exaggerated beyond. They're pushed a little further than what really happened and all of that to see, you know, what would happen. So it's, some of the characters Audrey's based on my little sister, and Johnny's based on me, but maybe the way we behaved a little bit. But once you start writing the novel, it's no longer the biographical people. It becomes the fictional people become the important character. Where you owe your, as a writer, where you owe your loyalty is to the people you've made up.
You have I think you told me you have a background in social work before you became a novelist.
Right.
So did that come into play?
What happened? When I got out of college, I needed to go to work. In those days, this is the 1970, actually, when I got out of college. And so I had been involved in a lot of, as many of us were, left-wing kind of politics and the war stuff and, you know, racial integration, all that kind of stuff. So I grew up wanting to save the world rather than go to college. And so I said, well, I'll do it one person at a time. I'll become a social worker, you know. But what happened was I ended up working first in my own neighborhood, which is in those days was called a model cities neighborhood, which is where they poured federal money in because it was poor and that kind of stuff. And so we had a neighborhood center, which was there when I was a kid. I went to it when I was a kid. I grew up and now I'm working in it. And I was what they called a youth worker. I worked in the street and I was working at that time with kids that were on drugs, a lot of, LSD and Succinol in those days. And they were all little kids, most of them thrown out of school. They were in elementary schools and all of that. I worked with them. Then I worked in a crisis center, suicide prevention hotline. And so we met all the kind of people who were in desperate straits and people living on the street and homeless people. I had a drop-in center where they would come in every day. And so I got to hear an incredible amount of stories of desperation and heartache, and I'm still writing off that the people that I met in those days.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So you had a professional immersion in the kind of stew that you write in. You're listening to American Variety. I'm your host Court Lewis. We're talking with my guest John Dufresne, who's an author. He's written the book Requiem Mass that we're talking about today. He's a professor of creative writing at Florida International University in Miami. You know, John, I'd like to turn to talking about the specific mental illness that the woman in your book has, which was intriguing to me, and I looked it up and researched it a bit, and it's something that I bet that very few people in my audience have heard of, called the Capgras syndrome.
Right, right.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I came across it in 1998 or 1998 or 99. a doctor named R.S. Ramachandran, who's at San Diego State, I believe. Anyway, he wrote a book called Phantoms of the Brain, which was a study of sort of things that had gone wrong, either organically or by accident, in people's perceptions and delusions and so forth. And in there, he had a chapter on Capgras syndrome, and that was fascinating to me. And what it is a person are suddenly unable to recognize the people closest to them, husbands, wives, children, and that's what it is in this case. And something has gone wrong in either the facial recognition or the connection between facial recognition and the emotional response to that face. Mm. And so in this case, the mother thinks the children have been replaced by imposters, and she calls them aliens, and she doesn't have the same problem with her husband. And it also, another element of it is that it is something to do with facial recognition, because if Johnny calls her on the telephone, she recognizes him and she knows who he is and she can talk to him. But if he were then to walk in the room, it would be the imposter is back. Mm-hmm. And so it's that. And it's, to me, certainly the pain that the mother's not aware of her pain, that's kind of another whole other element, because she doesn't think anything's wrong with her, that it's, there's some kind of conspiracy going on, run by she's not quite sure whom. And these kids are the puppets, and there's some puppet master somewhere. But also the children having to live with that, the children having to like realize their mother doesn't, the person they need to get love from the most can't give it to them.
Well, doesn't the mother that they know they're living with doesn't believe that they're her children?
That's correct.
And so that's actually correct. You know, if you want to look this up, it's CAPGRAS syndrome, named after a French psychiatrist who, I guess, first published it in the medical literature in 1923. But that's the absolute classic characteristic of it, is that you think that your loved one or ones are an imposter.
Right.
And it may take different forms in the way they are imposters. In your book, it's that the real children have been abducted by aliens, and that the aliens have replaced them with these clever look-alike body doubles that, you know, look and sound exactly like the right ones, but they're not her children, you know. And actually, you know, again, I looked into this a little bit before doing the show. It's a case of delusional disorder, what used to be called paranoid disorder.
Right.
Being a scientist, I try to kind of categorize things and make a taxonomy out of it, right? So it's a subset of delusional disorder, and that in itself, in turn, is a form of psychosis, right? So a lot of people, me included, are not really clear on the difference between, you know, neurosis and psychosis and schizophrenia, but it's not schizophrenia. It's a different thing. And in fact, it's like people who have delusional disorder, whether it's Capgras syndrome or some other form of it, and there are other types. There's like delusional jealousy, like extremely irrational, extreme jealousy with no basis in evidence or fact, is a form of paranoid delusion, right? And then there's like the persecution delusion that the FBI or the CIA is after you, or some sort of shadowy network of people are following you for some unknown purpose, that kind of thing. And so those are persecution and persecutory delusion, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other ones. But anyway, it's kind of interesting. But overall, delusional disorder apparently affects about 3 out of 10,000 people, right? So that's 1 in 3,000 some odd people, statistics being what they are. Let's say it's in that ballpark, right? But then the Capgras syndrome is extremely rare within that, and there are only like 1,000 or so people in the whole country who have that. So.
And I think it's prevalently female, too, I believe.
Yeah, it's like 2/3 female, something like that.
And, you know, that's a mystery that, as a fiction writer, I don't have to try to solve it or explain any of it. There it is, and let's see how it affects the people around her and herself in the long run. And she becomes a dangerous person at one point. She's certainly neglecting the kids and sort of emotionally abusive, even though she doesn't think she's being. But then at some point, she's even getting to the point where she may harm herself in here, when she decides at one point in the novel that she's going to bathe herself in gasoline.
Oh, wow. I didn't read that part.
And then that's going to wash away all the things on her. And she also does that with a cigarette in her hand, unlit. So, and the worst doesn't happen. She's saved by someone. But at that point, somebody's got to do something. Somebody needs to step in. The children can't be the ones to do it. They can alert people. But so then we find ourselves dealing with the mental health system And of course, this is set in the 60s here, late 60s. And in Massachusetts, which actually the city I grew up in has which is now closed, the oldest asylum in the country, Worcester State Hospital, was the first asylum. And as part of my work, I actually, back in the 70s, actually worked with the state hospital a bit and got training. And it was a time when they were letting people out. I don't know if you, and this plays into the novel as well, they were letting people out of the state hospitals. And you know, I don't know what the term was at the time, I don't remember, but mainstreaming, I guess, you know, get them back out there. And so they built a number of, they bought old tenement buildings in Worcester. This is Requiem. They built old tenement, and they put people, you know, sort of like halfway houses, going to get back. And so you would have these, and it is where Mom ends up here in one of those. And Johnny ends up visiting her and meeting, of course, all kinds of people living there who are, you know, and the year before that would have been, you know, no chance of ever getting out. But here they are out in the world and trying to make a go of it. And for some people, it was a blessing, and for others, it was a curse.
Well, that's something I want to get into, actually. I wanted to spend maybe half the show talking about your book, John, and then maybe the other half is kind of, let's call it in quotes, public service, you know, talking about the mental health system. Because in looking into it and reading some of the blogs about, I mean, this is such an intriguing thing, this Capgras syndrome.
Yeah.
I learned something about the way the mental health system works or doesn't work, you know. And so our health system in general, healthcare system, is very advanced and high tech, but it's not really the case with the mental health system. And so one reason is, in the case of this delusional disorder that we're talking about, with Capgras syndrome being a specific case of it, that the person acts normal apart from their delusions.
Right.
That's one of the characteristics that distinguishes it from schizophrenia, where the person acts distinctly non-normal. Schizophrenia, they have hallucinations, and they'll, you know, walk around talking to themselves, and it's, you know, it's not their earbud on their cell phone that they're talking to. It's unseen persons or whatever, but they don't have hallucinations, and they're rational. They function normally. They can hold down a job and so on, and they can recognize that people don't accept their delusions, you know, so they'll keep them kind of under wraps, or they can compartmentalize it to some extent. But the delusion itself is just very fixed, and the person develops a whole self-contained kind of worldview wrapped around it, in which everything is explained in terms of that delusion, and everything that kind of runs counter to it becomes something that no matter how far-fetched the justification for how the fact is not really what it seems, no matter how far-fetched the rationale can be, the person makes that rationale connection, you know. So the weird thing is that the mental health system, and you know, and maybe I hope you know something about this, and we can have like a two-way conversation here about it. But the mental health system is not really geared to money from insurance. There's not the money in it that the rest of the healthcare system has. And so, to my surprise looking into it, and I think maybe to the surprise of other people listening, it's kind of stuck back in the 60s or maybe the 70s. I'm not sure what. I haven't known much about it or had any real exposure to it. But it's there's not the money for treatment. And so the primary thing is kind of an in-and-out process like you described just then. In Florida, it's under the Baker Act, which is the short version name of the Florida mental health law. And a person who is adjudged to be mentally ill and a danger to themselves or others can be, I guess the verb is, Baker-acted by anyone, whether it's a loved one or police or someone out in the community who sees somebody acting in a bizarre way.
Yeah, if they're going to harm themselves or somebody else, then you can enforce that, get it enforced. And so
that's the criterion for it. But then what is it? What happens?
They get, I think, a few days, maybe 5 days, 72 hours or something, where they get in. And they get some kind of assessment and treatment, and then, well, then it goes on from there. And I've had to deal with this in my own life, in terms of not having money for it, where I have, without going into the details, I've had to shell out a lot of money because Blue Cross would not pay a penny of treatment for a mental health problem.
Or there's a little bit, like $1,000
a year.
Yeah,
well, this was zero.
You know, but I mean, the cost is such that $1,000 and zero are not very different.
Yeah, and it's just, and so that, and I know that, and I've actually had to look into the Marchman Act, which is another kind of Baker Act for drug addiction kind of thing for people that recently. And again, it's the same sort of thing. It's like, you know, the medical, we have the greatest medical system, as you said, you know, technological medical, medical system in the world, but we don't have the best delivery system.
Well, and it runs on money too.
Yeah.
So where there's no money, that limb of the tree doesn't have any fruit hanging on it.
Yeah. If you're poor, you don't have, you're out of luck. You're not going to get that great technology. And there's also this idea of, it's a holdover it was more true in the time when my book was set than it is now, but where there's a social stigma attached to mental illness. And
sure.
It wasn't,
yeah.
when I was growing up and there was mental illness in our family, it was not mentioned.
Yeah.
In the same way that I had a Down syndrome aunt. Mm-hmm. It was like, put her away. Nobody's going to know that this ever happened.
Right.
It was just, everything was a secret. Everything, the family was ashamed.
Right.
That'd
be like incest or
yeah.
something. It's a taboo almost.
And it's also, now, so if you know somebody that has any kind of delusion, schizophrenia, somebody that's going to harm themselves, and it's your responsibility to Baker Act them, or somebody has to do it, that's difficult for you to do. That's a horrible thing. And having to think about this myself recently, it was like, I don't want to be the one to do that. I don't want, it's like, that's the only hope they have. Yeah, but I don't, I wish I wasn't put in the position to have to do this.
Yeah, you intrude on their life in a life-changing way that brings it out into an open system, where everybody, a lot of people know about this all of a sudden.
And, right.
But I mean, I think that what you said is absolutely true, that in the past, 30, 40, certainly 50 more years ago, it was a taboo subject, basically. If you had the aunt who was chronically depressed and she never left her bedroom, she never left her bedroom. Somebody would bring her food and that was that. But I think that the, let's call it, if I can, and I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but the milder forms of mental illness like depression and so on have come much more into the mainstream. And I mean, you see, antidepressant medication advertised on TV. There's no real stigma with that anymore. And everybody recognizes that the stresses of modern life can make you depressed for a while.
Yes.
Or that you can be more prone to it than other people. Or certainly that drugs and alcohol can increase the propensity for a person to become mentally ill for a while, that kind of thing. But I think it's the more severe mental illnesses like these that we're talking about here, like psychosis and schizophrenia, that people still, A, don't know much about, and B, are also still afraid of.
And they're so difficult to treat.
Yeah,
and they have said the prognosis is not always very promising, and it's like it's just difficult, and it's a long haul, and it takes a long time, and as you said, it takes a lot of money. If it's going to take a lot of time, it's going to take a lot of money, and where's the money going to come from?
Well, that's if you can pay for it, and so the system that's there for mental illness, because it's not really fueled by insurance money like the regular non-mental, like the physical health system is, you can't afford to go into it. You have to either pay for it day by day, which will immediately pretty quickly bankrupt most people, or you go into a system under kind of Medicaid, I guess it is, or Medicare, I'm not sure which, or maybe both, and there's no real money in that. So I think the system then has basically the person is medicated, and they're put in basically a tank kind of a situation.
Right, it's kind of a warehouse, and it's kind of everything's being treated with, and thank God it is, but with medication. But then, but that's it, and it's like, you got your medicine. Let me know how it's working. I'll switch the medication. That's all it is. It's not like, I'm not a psychologist, a psychiatrist. I don't know Capgras syndrome. Is there any hope there at all? And so how would they treat it otherwise? But then the medications, as we all know, the medications then become a problem. Medications, they become addicted to medications and can't live without medication. In Broward County, where I live, there are more pain centers, quote-unquote pain centers, than there are McDonald's restaurants, right? There are 175, I think, or 76 pain centers, which are essentially giving out oxycodones, giving out any kind of medication you want. You just show up the thing. And now, so we have this tremendous drug addiction problem, prescription medication drug addiction problem, and that's also a mental health issue that's not being addressed.
So the way this plays out then with the Baker Act, which is a 72-hour involuntary period of being held for mental evaluation and treatment, obviously you're not going to be treated effectively for a severe mental illness in 3 days, and then you're released.
Right.
Unless there is evidence that you are still a great danger to yourself, in which case goes before a panel, and a judge rules whether or not you can be held for another 30 to 60 days for more medication and more of the
same.
And
that's what, it's not like treatment, really, and it's just kind of
it's the same thing, only 10
times. Just treading water, right, yeah, and that's right. It, and you're in a miserable kind of environment, right, because you're not at home, you're not getting any love or attention that you might be getting there.
And so here's the catch-22 that, you know, I read on blogs and so on with people who have the delusional disorder, where, as I said earlier, on the one hand, they act normal and seem normal except for this delusion, and they perceive things normally except for that. And so here they are in a warehouse situation with every kind of extreme mental illness around them, which is not good for your mental health.
Not at all.
And then the other thing is that they don't realize that they're sick. And so they will resist taking the medication if they are released and after 3 days, because they talk normally and say, you know, I'm fine, I don't need this, you know. And they won't take the medication, and they're immediately then, you know, they're right back. If they never even changed at all, they're back immediately in the situation they were in.
And then they go back to the people that the imposters, the supposed imposters, and it triggers the whole thing all over again.
Yeah, who may have been the ones who Baker acted them, and so therefore there's a
resentment. That's added to it, right.
Yeah,
right.
So the whole thing kind of like spirals out of control.
It's a tragedy. It's very
so
sad.
So reading the stories of people who are afflicted with this in their families, it basically disintegrates their family.
Yeah.
Because the person does not realize they're sick, and because it's so expensive to treat, and maybe so difficult to treat, and so intractable to treatment. So,
and you would feel, even if you know, like these children and husband would be, it's like there's guilt anyway, and it's undeserved guilt. But you're not treating someone you're supposed to love the way that you want to treat them, because you can't anymore.
Yeah.
And it tears you up inside. You know?
Yeah. So the whole thing is, I think you can tell, listeners, that we're describing a situation here that's really horrible that I think most people aren't aware of. So I guess what I'm thinking is that maybe with the new mental health care system, whatever it is that's coming along, maybe there will be some greater attention paid to this, because the key to it is that there's no money in mental health.
Right.
And therefore, the facilities are kind of stuck in the 60s. And there's, the research, I guess, is probably limited, because you're talking about the human brain. I mean, you ever take a car to the shop, the hardest thing to fix is the electronics. If your CV joints are broken or your brakes need to be repaired, that's easy. But
100 million neurons in that brain.
I know. So,
it's a trillion, 100 trillion.
Oh, you know,
neurons.
Add a billion, trillion, pretty
whatever.
Soon you're talking real numbers. It's all a mystery, right?
Right.
So we don't really know how to deal with it except in the most crude way, So I'm hoping that in the future there will be more attention paid to it, more money spent on it, and more options. At least that insurance, whether it's national insurance or whatever, will provide more humane options for long-term care and treatment, and hopefully really effective treatment.
Yeah, I mean, we got to take care of each other. No one else is going to do it, right?
Yeah, there you go. So anybody who wants to look that up again, it's the Capgras syndrome, C-A-P-G-R-A-S. And there is a website for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which is called NAMI, N-A-M-I. I think it's NAMI.org. Look that up. Anyway, we've been talking with John Dufresne, an author, about his book, Requiem Mass, and that led us into the broader subject of mental illness and so on. But you can get that book at Amazon and all the major bookstores. It was published, I noticed, by W.W. Norton and Company, which is a major publisher. I mean,
They've done all my books. I've been fortunate to stay with them.
Yeah, so that's a major mainstream publisher. It's published out of New York. Very nice book. I recommend it. Again, Requiem Mass. And John Dufresne's homepage is www.johndufresne, I'll have to spell the last name, D-U-F-R-E-S-N-E.com. JohnDufresne.com. Vous êtes français? You're from Quebec?
From Quebec. That's right. They're from the old country, as we call it, or the old province.
The old country? Yeah. That's more Irish, I think. I don't know. But it could be what they call it. I don't know. But anyway, thanks so much for being on with us, John.
That's great. Thanks for asking me to come.
It's been interesting, and I appreciate all of you being with us and listening, and I hope you will tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.